Hey everybody, Marcus here. We are all aware of the fanaticism that can take root in the hearts and minds of religious people. It could be easily described as a febrile madness that paints every belief and value that presents itself for evaluation. But please, do not confuse my meaning. I do not wish to invoke images of suicide bombers or other acts of terrorism. I do not speak of the extremist who uses religion as his justification. No. I mean those people who in every way are well integrated and decent members of society, but hold religious convictions so strongly that they are beyond the reach of reason. But here too, I do not wish to invoke images of irrationality. I simply mean that these people, for any other subject, would be open to discussing their position, you know, offer their arguments, listen to counter-arguments, and in a serious way attempt to temper their beliefs based on all information they are presented with. The people I am referring to are those religious fanatics who, when faced with the subject of their faith, argue to win. They are not interested in taking counter-arguments seriously into consideration. These are the people who already believe they possess the truth, and as such only show frustration with their beliefs when they are challenged. You know, frustration at once again having to deal with someone stupid or ignorant. You know, frustration at the fact that their interlocutor cannot see reason, cannot see their reason. I think we've all encountered this sort of individual at one point or another. We look at them as doubly sad. For in the first case, we see impenetrable ignorance, while in the second case, we see that they are capable of freeing themselves from this ignorance, but vehemently choose not to. You see, these people are not ignorant in virtue that they believe in God and the beliefs that follow as a consequence of the faith they subscribe to. No, they are ignorant because they cannot account for why they believe what they believe. They cannot justify themselves. It turns out that their faith is itself a matter of faith and not a conclusion in a long argument. But this form of ignorance is not unique to theists. No, it is also present in atheists. The same febrile fanaticism that we can see in theists also exists in atheists. The infantile characterization of God as some man in the sky giving out arbitrary rules and sending people to hell who disobey, you know, it would be comical if it was not such a sad confession of ignorance on the part of the man making such a characterization. Where theist fanatics have the justification of their faith itself become an article of faith, so too there are atheists who have their justification for abstaining from faith be an article of faith. In both cases, justification becomes blind conviction devoid of reason. This video will hopefully help in explaining the core issues that are involved when tackling the question of God. It should benefit theists in understanding what is the philosophical grounding to believing in God in the first place. For atheists, it will give an understanding of what exactly they must necessarily reject and the consequences that may come from such a rejection. First, let us introduce and clarify three types of men. The first is the theist. This man explicitly makes the epistemological claim, "I believe in God." The second man is the agnostic, who makes the epistemological claim, "I do not know if God exists." And finally, we have the atheist, who claims, "I do not believe in God." Now, let us look at two ontological claims. They are as follows. 1. God exists. 2. God does not exist. Now, an epistemological claim differs from an ontological claim in that the first describes what a person knows, while the latter describes what exists. Now, it is uncontroversial to say that a theist, a man who makes the epistemological claim that he believes in God, would implicitly also be making the ontological assertion that God exists. It would not really make much sense to believe in God if you, at the same time, believed God did not exist. What about the agnostic? The agnostic makes the epistemological claim that he is not certain whether God exists or not. The agnostic, in turn, suspends judgment ontologically. He neither believes God exists, nor does he claim God does not exist. Finally, we have the atheist. Now, You would think that the position of the atheist would be obvious. You would assume that after making the epistemological claim that he does not believe in God, that he would also be making the ontological claim that God does not exist. Now, it is not necessary for an atheist to make this claim and still remain an atheist. So, let us divide atheists into two kinds. Let us say that the hard atheist claims that he does not believe in God and asserts that God does not exist. In contrast, we have the soft atheist. The soft atheist claims that he does not believe in God, but, like the agnostic, suspends judgment on whether or not God exists. Let us evaluate the soft atheist for a moment. The soft atheist has taken an agnostic ontological position in suspending judgment as to the existence of God, but has taken the atheistic epistemological position. This means that though the soft atheist does not know whether or not God exists, he chooses to live his life in a fashion that follows from the belief that God does not exist. Now, what if someone claimed that he does not know whether God exists, and also claimed he believed in God anyways and lived their life accordingly? Let us call this person the soft theist. Would you not consider such a life unjustified? Would not such a life's justification be an article of faith? Well, surely it would, for in both the case of the soft atheist and the soft theist, there's no belief that justifies their epistemological claim. So, under this account, it would seem that if a soft atheist were to be asked, "Why do you not believe in God?" he would necessarily need to answer, "Because I don't know if God exists." Now, this is not logically valid thinking. But perhaps I am being unfair to the soft atheist. Surely he would not answer in the way I have specified, but would say something as follows. "I do not believe in God because the existence of God has not been proven, and I only believe in what has been proven to exist." This, well, is a fair explanation, and a very common position. Well, one well-known soft atheist is Richard Dawkins. Though he used to be more of a hard atheist in his earlier days, he has softened his position where he no longer claims God does not exist. Now, let us look at the behavior of soft atheists. Do soft atheists typically praise or condemn the belief in God? Well, they typically condemn it. But does this behavior make sense for someone who claims not to know whether or not God exists? To explain this, we need to take a little detour. Let us look at Pascal's wager. And Pascal's wager goes something as follows. If you cannot be convinced one way or the other of God's existence, then you must wager whether God exists or not. And so we are asked, where are you going to place your bet? If you place it with God, you lose nothing, even if it turns out that God does not exist. But if you place it against God, and you are wrong, and God does exist, you lose everything. You lose God, eternity, heaven, and infinite gain. So, let us assess the two cases. If you bet on God and win, you win everything. If you lose, you lose nothing. Pascal's wager is the same as the typical argument you would hear, but what if you're wrong? Now, let us go back to the soft atheist and agnostic. Based on the potentially devastating consequences of being wrong, would it not logically follow to devote serious effort into trying to figure out if God exists or not? Now, I'm not suggesting that a soft atheist or agnostic should rush out and join some faith, but I would expect them to have a pressing need to find out the answer to this question one way or the other, to pick a side and act accordingly. Either come to the conclusion that God does not ontologically obtain and stop worrying about it, or, if you find the arguments for God compelling, assert that God does exist and act accordingly. Considering how high the stakes are, I would expect agnostics and soft atheists to behave in this manner. I would expect soft atheists and agnostics deeply involved in the inquiry into God's existence. However, we do not see soft atheists doing this at all. We only witness them attempting to convince others to cast off their faith. But we have shown earlier that to be epistemologically atheist while ontologically agnostic is an unjustified, arbitrary conviction. When taking Pascal's wager into consideration, would it not make more sense for a soft atheist to in fact choose the theist equivalent? Would it not have made more sense for them to become a soft theist? Someone who does not know whether or not God exists, but will hedge their bets in such a way as to minimize risk? I would posit it would make more sense to vote in favor of God if you are either agnostic or a soft ontological atheist. The hard atheist, it would be noted, is not affected by Pascal's wager. The hard atheist's ontological beliefs makes, well, Pascal's wager kind of irrelevant. And it coheres with their epistemological claim and justifies their epistemological claim. So, either soft atheists are ignorant of the position of weakness they are in, or they're stupid, or are disingenuous about their agnostic ontological claim. I posit that soft atheists are not stupid. So they are either ignorant or disingenuous. Of the two, I posit that, well, there are many who are disingenuous. The fanatical atheists I spoke of in the beginning of this video are of the type who wish to win at all costs. If this is the case, then it makes sense to claim a soft atheist position because it is much easier to defend than the position that the hard atheist takes. However, these disingenuous soft atheists are secretly hard atheists. It is this type of soft atheist I simply cannot respect. Their claim to pursue truth is heavily thrown into question. Now, let us move on to the hard atheist, the genuine and honest hard atheist. The hard atheist claims he does not believe in God and asserts that God does not exist. The epistemological position of the hard atheist is justified by his ontological belief. This position I can respect, and such a genuine hard atheist can be spotted, you know, by their open and proud assertion that God does not exist. But what happens if we remove the epistemological component and only focus on the ontological component? What if we ask the question, does God exist, to the theist, the agnostic, the soft atheist, and the hard atheist? The theist will say, yes. The agnostic and the soft atheist will say, I don't know. And the hard atheist will say, no. So by removing the epistemological component, we have in turn merged the agnostic and the soft atheist into one. After all, are we concerned with what people believe, or are we concerned with what exists? I would posit that we are concerned with what exists. Now, let us look at the theist for a moment. It is true that there are many monotheistic religions out there, you know, such as the various Protestant denominations, Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholicism, Islam and Judaism. Each of these faiths have their own particular rules and dogma. However, all of these faiths agree on at least one thing. They all agree that God exists. They differ on the details of the nature and will of God, but they do not differ on the ontological status of God. Cool. Now, what would the process look like if an agnostic were to turn into a theist? What process would someone take to go from having no faith to having faith? Well, surely this would be a two-stage process. In the first stage, the agnostic would need to come to believe in the existence of God. In the second stage, he would need to figure out which of the available religions have the correct interpretation of God, if any do at all. So, the first phase, going from ontological agnosticism to ontological theism, would look very different from the second phase, the selection of a particular religion. In this video, I will not concern myself with the second phase. I will only focus on the first phase. Now, the first phase is strictly concerned with the existence of God. The activity of defending the existence of God is called apologetics. Now, the branch of apologetics I am interested in is called natural theology. Natural theology does not rely on revelation, or scripture, or holy books, or any other religious artifacts. Natural theology asserts that knowledge of the existence of God is possible through the human faculties alone, namely through reason. As such, natural theology applies to all monotheistic religions. So, let's see what natural theology has to say. Okay, there are three, and only three, logical possibilities in answering the following question. Why is there a universe as opposed to nothing? The possibilities are 1. The universe came out of nothing. 2. The universe was created. And 3. The universe always existed. Now, it has been said that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Do not all three of these claims seem extraordinary, even magical? Let us consider the first claim, the universe came out of nothing. Now, let us say that I was to claim that I can run the 100 meters in under 10 seconds. You would take one look at me and, well, laugh in disbelief. But what exactly is that that you disbelieve? Is it the case that you believe that running 100 meters in under 10 seconds is impossible, or do you believe that though it is possible to do so, I, Marcus, do not appear to have the physique, therefore the ability itself, to do so? Well, you would be laughing for the second reason, namely, though you believe a person can run the 100 meters in less than 10 seconds, you do not believe that I, Marcus, possess this skill, and you would be right. But what if I were to say to you that I could conjure a kilo of gold out of nothing? In this case, you would laugh at me for the first reason. You would laugh not because you do not believe I possess the skill, but that the skill itself is not possible to possess. The possession of such a skill is not possible because the result itself is not possible. This is both intuitive and coherent with everything science seems to tell us about the constitution of the universe. So in this way, does it not seem magical to believe that somehow the entire universe came out of nothing, all on its own? Well, it does seem that way. What about the second possibility, namely that the universe was created? If the universe was created, then it surely has a creator. Let us call this creator God. Therefore, if the universe was created, then God created it. This, too, is an extraordinary claim. And finally, the third possibility states that the universe always existed. Again, another spectacular claim. So, when we consider our options, we can clearly see that in all cases, we are bordering on magic. But, of all three options, only the second option requires the existence of God. Now, the scientific consensus at the moment is that the universe originated with the Big Bang. If you subscribe to this account, then it logically follows that you exclude the possibility that the universe always existed. The Big Bang, however, is compatible with both the first and second option. However, if you are a hard atheist in addition to subscribing to the Big Bang theory, you also exclude the second option. This means that as a Big Bang hard atheist, you believe that the universe came from nothing. Now, there are those who subscribe to the multiverse theory, and this is fine and not immune to the three logical possibilities we have set forward. A multiverse is simply a larger structure whose existence can still be questioned in the same manner. For simplicity, though, I will stick to only one universe. Now, Dr. Lawrence Krauss, a physicist, celebrity scientist, and friend of Richard Dawkins, wrote a book entitled A Universe from Nothing. Dr. Krauss argues that indeed the universe could, did, and could only ever come out of nothing. Now, I've read the first chapter of this book, and I had to stop reading afterwards. Now, the reason I stopped reading was because Dr. Krauss, though a brilliant scientist, is an abomination of a philosopher. Within the first chapter, Dr. Krauss gives his account of what nothing is. After reading this, it was very clear that Dr. Krauss's nothing is the absence of certain things, but not the absence of all things. Air, as it appears on Earth, has an absence of gold. If I define nothing as an absence of gold, then I can say that air is nothing. Clearly, this is nonsense, because air, as it appears on Earth, is composed of nitrogen, oxygen, and so forth. However, Dr. Krauss does exactly what I just described. So, what is this something that Dr. Krauss seems to leave behind? Well, relativistic quantum fields. Though Dr. Krauss's theory is original in that he does not presuppose any form of matter, he does presuppose these fields. He goes on to say that certain field combinations disallow the possibility of matter, while other combinations allow matter. When a field combination moves from a state that disallows matter to a combination that allows it, matter pops into existence, from what he refers to as the quantum vacuum. Dr. Krauss treats this quantum vacuum as the nothing from which the universe emerges. However, he requires these quantum fields to exist as a presupposition. And in this way, it is no more interesting that matter pops into existence in this quantum field through the shift in arrangement of quantum fields than it is for a fist to pop into existence when I arrange my fingers in a certain way. Though Dr. Krauss has made a noble attempt to give a naturalistic account of how something could come out of nothing, well, he has failed short of his goal. However, there is something that I find incredibly revealing about his attitude towards the criticisms that philosophers had leveled on him. He disdains philosophers. He made a joke that I kind of find hilarious, but also kind of sad. Dr. Krauss said that you should never argue with a philosopher about nothing, because philosophers are truly masters of knowing nothing. His comments embody this atheistic fanaticism I mentioned before, a deeply rooted need to disprove the existence of God that will compel him to resort to sophistry in order to obtain the desired result. This redefinition of nothing to suit his thesis is a terrible omen if it becomes a mainstay tactic of the atheist community. But there's something more ominous than atheists using sophistry to attack God. It's scientists attacking philosophy. Dr. Krauss will not bend a knee to God, which is his choice, but he will bend a knee to logic. His attack on philosophy is an attack on reason itself, and this should concern anyone who looks to leaders in the sciences for truth. Now, there is another way in which the atheist can attack the existence of God. To do this, it would have to be shown that God is a logical impossibility. There is one metaphysical position that logically entails the impossibility of God. This metaphysical position is called materialism. A materialist asserts that all that exists is composed of some physical stuff. Now, I do not intend to go into the details of materialism in this video, well, as it's quite complicated. And also, materialism has more recently been renamed to physicalism. However, the argument against God from a materialist position goes something as follows. If all that exists is physical, then all that exists is subject to the laws of physics. Since God is understood to be outside the laws of physics, then God cannot be physical. If God is not physical, then God does not exist, or lacks the qualities theists assert are true of God. In order for a theist to fight against this argument, he would need to defeat materialism. This is a complex task that is outside the scope of this video. Physicalism, it should also be noted, is a very popular metaphysical position among scientists, and I strongly, strongly encourage everyone to investigate what this position entails. What I want to do now is to explore the second of our three possibilities, namely, that the universe was created. Now, there are 20 arguments that I know of that support the claim that God exists. I will explore one of these 20 arguments, namely, the cosmological argument, and more specifically, the Kalam cosmological argument. Now, the Kalam version of the cosmological argument goes as follows. First, we must establish whether or not the infinite can exist as an actuality or merely a potential. Let us take the following example to illustrate what we mean by this. Imagine you are sitting on the couch in your living room. Further, let us say that you wish to walk to the refrigerator in your kitchen. First, you would need to stand up and begin walking toward your refrigerator. However, before you get to your refrigerator, you would need to get to the halfway mark between your couch and your refrigerator. Once you got to that point, you will now need to walk the remaining half of the distance. Now, before you can get to your refrigerator from that point, you will need to get to the halfway mark from the halfway mark between your couch and refrigerator. Once you get to that point, you now find yourself 3/4 of the way to the refrigerator. But now you need to walk the remaining quarter. To do this again, you will first need to get to the halfway mark. So in this way, by dividing the remaining distance in half and only walking the half at a time, you can divide the distance between your couch and refrigerator an infinite amount of times. But if there was an actual infinite in the way described, then you would never reach your refrigerator. This is a version of Zeno's paradox. It says that if an actual infinity were to exist, you would never be able to cross it. But we all know you will breach the refrigerator. Therefore, there is no actual infinite, only potential infinite. The distinction between the potential infinite and the actual infinite is the solution that Aristotle gives to Zeno's paradox. Aristotle denied the existence of the actual infinite, both in the physical world and in mathematics, but he accepted potential infinites there. And by calling them potential infinites, he did not mean they have the potential to become actual infinites. Potential infinite is a technical term that suggests a process that has not been completed. The term actual infinite does not imply being actual or real. It implies being complete, with no dependency on some process in time. The full arguments can be found in Aristotle's work entitled Physics, Book 4, Chapter 2, and Physics, Book 6, Chapters 2 and 9. But how does this relate to anything? Well, if the universe is eternal, then it implies there is an infinite past. The consequences are deductively captured in the following argument. 1. An actual infinite cannot exist. 2. An infinite history of past events is an actual infinite. 3. Therefore, an infinite history of past events cannot exist. 4. Therefore, the universe has a finite history of events. 5. Therefore, there was a first event. 6. Therefore, the universe had a beginning. Now that we have shown that the universe must have had a beginning, there are four logical ways in which the universe could have come to exist. 1. It was created by nothing. 2. It created itself. 3. It was created by something else that was created. 4. It was created by something that itself is uncreated. For the first case, it was created via nothing, we must first understand what we mean by nothing. What we mean by nothing means the absence of something, and in this case, the absence of the universe. This definition makes sense because we have deductively argued that the universe began and therefore it was once not there. There was an absence of the universe. This is also undeniable due to the deductive nature of the argument. So, with this definition, we can conclude that for the universe to come out of nothing is nonsense on logical grounds. Therefore, the universe could not have come out of nothing. This is also justified by arguments offered by Parmenides in proving that something cannot come out of nothing, and is also a fundamental first principle in science. Indeed, if it was true that something could come out of nothing, then it is not possible to justify why things do not just randomly pop into being on a day-to-day basis. Now, let us look at the second option, namely, could the universe create itself? Well, this implies that the universe was in existence and not in existence at the same time, which is an impossibility. A crude example of this can be summarized in the following question. Can your mother give birth to herself? Obviously not. So we know self-creation is not possible. Let us look at the third option, namely, could the universe be created by something that itself was created? We can argue that to offer this account as the ultimate cause of how the universe began would be illogical and irrational. The universe could not be the result of another universe, for example, because of the absurdity of an infinite regress. Imagine this universe as universe 1 being the result of another universe. Let us call it universe 2. And universe 2 being the result of another universe, namely universe 3, and so forth ad infinitum. The consequences of such a regress would be that we would not have the universe today, as there would be no series of actual causes, and only a series of non-existence. Due to the fact that there is existence found around us, it follows that the ultimate cause is something other than temporal causes. So now we are left with the final possibility, namely, that the universe was created by something that is uncreated. Now, clearly, theists and atheists can agree on one thing. If anything exists at all, there must be something preceding it that always existed. How did this eternally existing reality come to be? The answer is, that it never came to be. It always existed. Now take your pick, an uncreated creator or the universe. Something always existed. And since we have previously argued deductively that the universe began, the universe could not have always existed. This leaves an uncreated creator as the only logical possibility. Now, this does not mean that God exists, only that there was an uncreated creator. To help us get to God as we typically understand him, we need to examine what must be true of this uncreated creator. The following things must hold true for the uncreated creator. 1. The uncreated creator must be eternal by definition because he is uncreated. 2. The uncreated creator must be transcended, distinct, and different from the universe. 3. The uncreated creator must have a will, for if he's eternal and brought into existence a finite entity that began, like the universe, he must have chosen the universe to come into existence, and choice indicates a will. 4. The uncreated creator must be powerful, as he had the ability to create the universe. 5. The uncreated creator must be perpetually knowing, because if he is eternal and he established rules like the law of gravity, this implies he is a law giver. Therefore, we can make the inference that he is perpetually knowing or perpetually intelligent. 6. Finally, the uncreated creator must be one. Let us use Occam's razor to demonstrate this final point. Occam's razor means that one must have a simple, comprehensive account that has great explanatory scope and explanatory power. Though it does not follow that an account necessarily must be simple, as it concerns the oneness of the divine, the argument that the uncreated creator must be one is simple and more comprehensive than the alternatives. For example, if you say there are two, three, or more uncreated creators, the explanation stops being simple and does not answer all questions. In fact, such an account creates far more questions than it answers. You know, questions such as, how do two, three, or more causes co-eternally exist? So, to sum up, we've concluded that there must be an uncreated creator that is eternal, transcendent, has a will, is powerful, perpetually knowing, and uniquely one. For the intents and purposes of most theists, this is an accurate description of God. The best known defender of this argument is William Lane Craig. You can find debates between him and various atheists, including Richard Dawkins, on YouTube, and I encourage you to do the footwork and see what Craig's opponents have to say in opposition to this argument. Of course, there are ways in which one can attack the Kalam cosmological argument. The interesting thing is not that one can defeat the argument, but the cost of such a victory. For example, if you decide to attack Parmenidean ontology and defend the position that something can indeed come out of nothing, you are not only bound to this reality in relationship to the question of God, no, you are also bound to all the consequences that follow from such a position as it relates to all of your beliefs. The challenge of defeating a sophisticated argument like this one, is that you might end up committing yourself to absurdities far greater than the one you are trying to disprove. Okay. This is but one argument, and as I said, there are 19 others that I know of, and there are probably more than that. What I hope you have taken away from this video is twofold. Firstly, I hope that you have experienced a better appreciation for the depth and style of argumentation that serious thinkers deal with as far as the ontological status of God is concerned. I mean, these are not the televised hillbillies peddling an earth that is 12,000 years old or asserting that dinosaur bones were placed on earth by God to test our faith. No, the cretins who deal in that sort of nonsense can be safely dismissed. Serious theists bring to the table solid arguments, and these arguments cannot be simply swept under the rug as the stakes are very high. Secondly, I hope that you appreciate that, like on the theist side, atheists can wield their own sophistry and cannot be taken at their word without close scrutiny. In fact, as the consequences of getting the wrong answer as to the existence of God are so high, I don't trust the proponents of either side. I feel that if for no other question, the labor that needs to be enacted and answering it rests on me alone. The quest to answer this question is not something I am willing to delegate. I think that no one should delegate this quest. And more importantly, I think that individuals need to treat this question a lot more seriously than what modern culture expects from us. And even if the end of your quest brings you to atheism, there is a deeper question that will still require your attention. Are there consequences that I will suffer after death that are contingent on the life I choose to live? Both the Indian notion of reincarnation and Nietzsche's thesis of eternal recurrence are atheistic in nature, and they both espouse post-death consequences. It would be foolish to not even try to figure this out. Thanks for listening. Go team.